Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
Hey, just a quick heads up before we get started. This episode deals with sexual violence, and it may not be for everyone. From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When Aspen Mattis started hiking the Pacific Crest Trail, she was looking for solitude, safety, escape. She writes about it in her essay, which is read by comic and actor Cameron Esposito. Cameron's stand-up special is called Rape Jokes and explores sexual assault from the survivor's perspective.
When I was packing to leave college in the spring of my freshman year, shoving jeans and t-shirts and mittens into my suitcase and crying, I spoke with my parents on the phone. I told them I was unimpressed by school. I told them I was cold in Colorado, even in April. But I'd already told them what really made me decide to leave. I had been raped. On my second night at school, I had invited a girl and two boys I'd met, all of us new freshmen, to watch The Breakfast Club in my dorm room. Classes hadn't yet begun, and we were wandering from dining hall to orientation activity to campus safety lecture without certainty or friends or direction. When the movie ended, the thin boy left with the freckled girl. A half minute later, I said an awkward bye to the other boy, who was sitting on my bed. He did not leave. I remember hearing the sound of the button from my shorts hitting the floor and feeling as still as soft dead wood. I said, "Stop. Stop it." But not loud enough, maybe. I should have kicked him. I should have screamed. Afterward, I asked him if he wanted to stay, to sleep over, because I desperately wanted to think I had wanted this, to feel that everything was fine. He said I was crazy to ask for that. He knew what he'd done. But he was lucky. My irrational request would later fog the clear act and help spare him from expulsion and conviction and shame. I felt shame. A few weeks later, too late for physical evidence to still exist, I went to the campus's sexual assault counselor. She suggested the matter be pursued at the school with a mediator. She filed papers. I testified. He testified. But the mediator found our he said, she said narrative inconclusive. When I heard this decision, I hardened my cheeks and the little muscles behind my eyes. I saw dust suspended. I could not move. I was not sure what the next move was. I didn't think there was a next move. On the phone that stone gray April day, I told my parents in Boston that I was leaving college to walk 2,650 miles from Mexico to Canada and be alone. They thought I must be unstable, not sane. But they felt my conviction and did not resist. I flew to Los Angeles with a big backpack, with trail mix, granola bars, chocolate, cheese, and a tent. My father met me and drove me south into Death Valley, where we stayed the night in a dim hotel. I hardly remember the place. Just the heat. In the morning, we went farther south, through more desert. In the car, we didn't talk much. We referred to my sadness, but never said rape. At the Mexican border, my father filled my water bottles and watched me swing my legs back and forth off the minivan trunk and eat cold pizza. When I was fed and silent long enough, he started the rental car and drove up the dirt road north, away. I was alone, finally. There was a border monument marking the southern end of the Pacific Crest Trail, which fades in the mist and lush of northern Washington, and then ends. Canada. I would walk the height of the country. A rust-brown corrugated metal fence rippled along the Mexican border as far as I could see. Here the desert dips and swells like the sea, and among the dusty waves I saw no one. But I wasn't scared of the solitude. Desert wilderness, I believed, was the safest place. And I knew how to walk. The trail was marked with rusty signs. Scattered rattlesnakes basked in the sun. I was eating a green apple when I nearly stepped on the first one. I shrieked and ran south 100 yards. I bit my apple, breathed, chewed. That apple was my only piece of fresh food. Everything else was processed or salted or junk. I walked north, stepped over the snake, kept walking, stepped over another and another. Within a few hours, I had met a dozen hikers, all attempting the same trans-country journey, young men and retired couples, and a friendly 30-year-old woman with curly hair and good teeth who smiled at me. I made friends and allowed myself to smile back and answer honestly when asked that common trail question. Why? Why are you doing this? We all had reasons. My answer became, I'm walking from Mexico to Canada to raise money for the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, RAIN, a nonprofit organization committed to helping rape victims heal. I said it just like that, fast. From the edge of a motel bed in a town in north central California, I called my mother and told her about my stated reason for walking. She said, no, I couldn't tell people that. I couldn't ask my uncles and aunts and cousins and grandmothers for money for that. It would kill them to know. If I didn't tell them, she said, she would donate $1,000 herself, more than you could possibly raise. Through the dirt-framed window of my motel room, I saw a little girl scramble up to the top of a mound of rocks. Her face was sunlit, and church bells bonged the hour. My cell phone felt hot. I closed it without saying okay. But as my mother wished, I stopped telling people, stopped trying to raise money, and changed my answer back to something fuzzy and bright. Because $1,000 seemed like a lot. A week later, in the next town, I went online, checked my fundraising webpage, and saw she had donated $1,060 to help rape victims. I kept walking, the volcanic rock like a husk of dead earth beneath my running shoes. I screamed to hear my echo, and with each footfall heard the crunch of gravel. I met a new group of hikers and hiked faster and for more hours than I otherwise would have to stay with them. In Bend, Oregon, nearly 2,000 miles north of the Mexican border, I met Justin, 20-something and handsome. He was also a Mexico to Canada walker, and we knew a handful of the same hikers. About 10 of us went out to dinner at a brewery where Justin sat next to me, close. He smiled a lot. I smiled too. Tried not to, but I couldn't help it. Under the table, his knee brushed mine. I lifted my hand, moved it slow through the space between us, like a teenage boy trying to float unnoticed to second base. I pressed my trembling palm against Justin's sweating beer, squeezed the glass, lifted and carried it through the air to my mouth. Took a sip. I was 19. Underage. Justin knew it. He was amused and contorted his face like he disapproved. I was always hungry then. The hunger made me feel beautiful. We walked out of town together, heading north. We were 600 miles from Canada. On our first full day of hiking together, rain poured in sheets, smacking the soil. The world shone in gray light. Justin and I shouted over the downpour, sharing stories and hopes. We were drenched, but giddy. Rain dissolved the trail. It was a muddy stream, and we splashed through it, and the evergreens smelled sweet of sap and clean wood. When about a week later I answered for him the why of my walk, I was raped. He opened his warm arms, let me step in, and closed them around me. When I was hungry, he set up his stove and cooked for me quinoa or pasta or even something with meat. I had not, on the long walk, brought a stove. Everything I'd eaten on the trail in the 3 months pre-Justin had been cold. When I cried, I did sometimes, he held me. He kissed my head and neck and didn't stop until I stopped. When I was freezing, wet, and maybe near hypothermic, he stood in the icy rain and set up my tent and helped me into it and out of my soaked clothes and into his dry goose down vest and sleeping bag. That night he nearly froze. I was warm, and I already loved him. At the trail's end, we held each other and kissed. "We're done," I said. He said, "Now's the scary part." It seemed an arbitrary end. I stood in that forest spot and stared at Justin's face. I heard a car's tinny engine and could see through the trees an old Jeep passing. Just over a year later, we returned to those same mountains. A backlit mist bathed the Cascade foothills in silver as Justin and I read our vows before a justice of the peace. We grinned and cried, and I said, "I do," on a stone stage in a mountain garden. All around us, lightning flashed like cameras. My parents were there too, happy and warm.
That's Cameron Esposito performing Aspen Mattis's essay, A Hiker's Guide to Healing. We asked Cameron why she chose this piece.
Too often it seems like we either use sexual assault as a person's origin story, like the source of someone's power, or as something that is never again revisited in that person's life. And I will say for me, you know, it's a part of my life, and it's a part of my life on a daily basis. It's also not why I'm powerful, and it's not why I'm interesting. I really liked this essay because it speaks to that. It speaks to somebody who is healing themselves and who had a life before this happened to them and who also has a life after.
Thanks again to Cameron for reading this week's piece. Her stand-up special is called Rape Jokes, and you can watch it on her website, CameronEsposito.com. We'll catch up with Aspen Mattis after the break. Aspen and Justin eventually made it to New York City. She finished college and began to make her living as a writer. But Justin struggled in New York. Aspen says that he missed the wilderness. Then, in 2013, they learned that their close friend Michael, who had introduced them on the Pacific Crest Trail, had died by suicide. His funeral was in New Hampshire.
Justin woke me up with a kiss at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to Michael's funeral. And I had decided that I didn't want to go. I thought I couldn't handle it, and I just wanted to stay in New York. But Justin was going to go to the funeral. And that night, he didn't come home. And I was obviously really worried. And then the next day, he didn't come home. And then a few days passed, and I called his brother, and he also had not heard from Justin. And then I called his parents, and they didn't know where he was. And then pretty quickly we realized that no one knew where he was and that Justin was a missing person.
After 43 days, they finally heard from Justin when he reached out to Aspen.
And it was just a 2-line email, and it was something along the lines of, "Hey, I hope you're doing well. Could you please mail some of my climbing gear and warm clothing to Colorado?" And I was just shocked. Like, there was no address and there was no apology or explanation. And at the time, I was really upset. And that was the end, really. The end of our marriage was his disappearance from my life and from the world.
Aspen says that Justin didn't know how to express that their life in New York wasn't what he wanted.
What he decided to do was just to leave. And while that's not like the most mature or certainly the easiest way for him to have left, I do totally understand him because I have a lot of that in me too. And I don't regret being married to Justin or anything like that. I think he had a really positive impact on the trajectory of my life, and I feel really grateful that we got to walk together for those 4 years that we were together.
Aspen also says that it was difficult to move on romantically after everything that had happened.
For a while after Justin disappeared, I was trying to protect my heart, and so I would only get involved with people who I didn't really like that much, or like certainly that I didn't love. That really lasted until I met my current boyfriend, and I love him. And it would be really scary and sad if it didn't work out, but of course that's also possible.
Aspen says she was afraid to put her story in front of such a large audience. She worried that readers would think her experience wasn't really rape because she'd asked the boy to sleep over, but that wasn't what happened.
I was blown away by the responses that I got, which were, "This happened to me too," or, "I was raped when I was in college and now I'm 45 and I've never talked about it, and thank you so much for your piece." A girl wrote, "I tutored my rapist in chemistry," and people took that as evidence that he didn't rape me. And I discovered that all of these people had thought they must be the only one and this must be evidence that they were somehow crazy, when in fact, it's a tremendously common reaction. After an assault, after something so huge and shocking, the last thing you want to do is to admit to yourself that you were raped. And the easiest and most natural thing to do in the immediate aftermath is to somehow find a way to deny it. If you do know someone who is sexually assaulted, believe them and tell them, "This was not your fault. You didn't cause this. Rapists cause rape. Nothing causes rape other than rapists." And if you've just been assaulted, know that you didn't cause this. And also know that, for me, this rape was not the end of my life, even though it felt like it might be at the time.
That's Aspen Mattis. Her memoir is called Girl in the Woods. She's a writer living in New York City. We've got more after the break. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for The New York Times.
A question I often get when there are essays that really explore really traumatic experiences is, why go public, you know, in a forum like The New York Times with a story like that? And the answer is typically, like, silence wasn't working. You know, holding this in wasn't working. Vulnerability is power in a way. If you can talk about, you know, a traumatic experience and make sense of it in public, there is power in that. And the other sort of incentive for people to explore this material is to help others and to sort of break this code of silence about these experiences so there isn't shame attached to it.
Next week, Mike Coulter, star of the Netflix series Luke Cage.
Once the doctor had left, I told Deanna that if Comfort Care became our daughter's fate, we would not be there to watch her die. We would go home to our irrepressible boy and pretend none of this happened. We would tell ourselves this was a miscarriage. Never having known her, we would not know the pain of losing her.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Sound design and original scoring by Matt Reed. Our intern is Louisa Judge. Additional help this week from producer Catherine Brewer. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.